Bone-chilling greetings, everybody. Thanks so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your day. Those tunes are courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey. And of course, I'm your host, Tessa Morrow.
That made you call last night. Did I see us back together when I read between the lines?
Today we return back to London, and rather close to a site that I already did an episode on, the St. Paul's Cathedral. But this cannot be further opposite of what a cathedral is and what it stands for. No. A cathedral is where people gather to worship, honor, and pray. Where we are going is a place nightmares are made out of, the Newgate Prison and the Tyburn Gallows. Located right off the corner of Newgate Street and Old Bailey Street, it opened its doors in 1188 and would eventually shut down in 1902, making this location open for a whopping 714 years. To me, that's absolutely incredible. So impressive. Now, if you're planning on going to visit this ancient site, don't bother. Sadly, it was demolished back in 1904, just 2 years after it closes its doors for the final time. And to me, that's very sad because it's definitely a part of history. I absolutely hate when that happens to these beautiful historical buildings. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. The Newgate Prison, as I mentioned earlier, just has so much history behind it. It was a prison that the king would oftentimes hold traitors and other types of criminals in. Here is somewhat of a quick timeline for you. Now, in 1236, the king converts a turret, which was used as a main gate, into the city limits as an extension to the actual prison itself. This would include dungeons. In 1406, a tower and a chamber is constructed for the female inmates, finally separating them from the males for good. In 1419, Newgate shuts down temporarily after they experience a large number of prisoner deaths, which is mostly due to the extreme unsanitary conditions. In 1422, a license to renovate the prison is granted, and once renovation is completed, the prison now had a brand spanking new chapel, a mess hall, or what they referred to as a central hall, but same thing, it's where they ate. Also added on were three main wards and additional cells and chambers. In 1666, Newgate Prison is destroyed by the Great Fire of London, something that I talked about in an episode released back in mid-September of 2021, and it's titled The Resident Spirits of St. Paul's and the Great Fires of London. By 1672, Newgate Prison is rebuilt, and it is done so by an English architect, Christopher Wren. He was quite an impressive fellow who, after the Great Fire of London, rebuilt a whopping 52 churches in the city of London, including, of course, St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, mind you, as mentioned in the earlier episode, this is where Christopher Wren rests eternally in his crypt at St. Paul's. In 1769, construction begins to build an even larger prison, as let's face it, bad behavior, it does not take a break. And an Old Bailey Sessions house is added on. Construction is almost complete when in 1780 it is ambushed during the Gordon Riots and was unfortunately destroyed by yet another fire. Can they get a break here? It takes two additional years of construction for the prison to finally be completed in 1782. Throughout the centuries, Newgate Prison housed countless prisoners, While many were guilty of extremely violent and at times deadly offenses, some were just simply not. Like William Penn, the Quaker who founded the colony of Pennsylvania. He served a sentence here in Newgate for preaching in front of people on a public street, so nothing threatening or violent when it comes to William. I can't say the same, though, for Thomas Bainbridge. In 1728, he becomes the warden of the extremely notorious Fleet Prison, who opened their doors in 1197, closing down in 1844, and eventually is demolished 2 years later in 1846. So same thing with Newgate. When they closed down 2 years later, boom, no longer there. Thomas was a barbaric man who was notorious for treating the prisoners just absolutely horrible, and in the most cruelest of fashions. Besides this abuse, he is also found guilty of extortion. He dies here at Newgate in 1741. Executions originally were conducted at the Tyburn Gallows, but eventually moved to the prison, first right in the front of the prison itself for public executions. And that would come to an end, though, in 1868, when it was decided that the executions take place within the prison walls and more away from the public eye. And let's just say, no one was safe from the executioner. It didn't matter if you came from wealth, royalty, a beggar on the streets, or if you were the executioner yourself. Intrigued? Stay tuned. Before 1783, the doomed souls were to be executed at Tyburn Gallows. And I want to talk about some of those people right now. Now, William Fitz Osbert, he is believed to be the very first person executed here at Tyburn. He is stripped down completely naked and dragged to the location by a horse, where he is executed via hanging. This first execution would take place in 1196, a whopping 828 years ago. Oh, wow. April 20th of 1534, a woman named Elizabeth Barton is put to death. Now, this one is rather a sad story. She was known as the Holy Maid of Kent. Elizabeth was a 28-year-old nun, and in the past, as a young woman, she had these premonitions about things, and many times she proved to be accurate, as these things did end up happening later on in the future. Well, a lot of people took her for her word and trusted her, including King Henry VIII. We know things aren't going to end very well when we hear that name. Well, her mouth betrays her when she begins to say things about King Henry VIII, like if he remarried that he would die a short time afterwards. The nun and the king had met several different times where we see her sharing prophecies with him, and they are always what he wanted to hear, mind you. So he never minded. But this business of him dying did not sit well with the ever so notorious King Henry VIII, as he had distilled so much fear into the people. Elizabeth even told him that he would go to hell and described what she was seeing. Well, he marries Anne Boleyn. Now, her prediction, as we know, was wrong, and King Henry would live an additional 15 years after marrying Anne. Of course, we know poor Anne was not so lucky, and she would be executed, beheaded for treason. Now, Elizabeth, like Anne Boleyn, was found guilty of treason, and on April 20th of 1534, Elizabeth Barton and five of her main supporters, which consisted of two Benedictine monks, Edward Bocking and John Daring, a priest named Henry Gold, and two Franciscan friars, Hugh Rich and Richard Risby, they are all executed together. Of course, it was mainly Elizabeth that the king was so mad at, and it definitely shows. Her head is cut off and stabbed onto a spike, where it was put on display on the London Bridge. To this day, Elizabeth Barton is the only woman in history that this has ever happened to. Barton and the five executed with her would not be the only ones to be executed on King Henry VIII's orders. Two out of six of his wives would be executed. Several of his personal friends would be executed. And of course, people he didn't care for, nemesis, as well. No shocker there. I mean, if his own wives, family, and friends weren't safe, why in the hell would his nemesis be safe? He was an extremely a sick individual. He was on a complete power trip during his entire reign. Speaking of King Henry VIII, in 1537, he would use the Tyburn gallows to execute the ringleaders of the Pilgrimage of Grace. In 1571, the Tyburn Tree is erected. Known as the Triple Tree, it was a type of gallows where multiple people could be executed at one time. It was home to mass executions, as we will see in a little while. That very same year, on June 1st, John Story is Tyburn Gallows Tree first execution. Story was a Roman Catholic who was found guilty of treason, and he is ordered to be executed via hanging, drawn, and quartered. His last words, with the noose around his neck promising death, he begged for his life. He begged not to have them leave his wife and his four children, for his wife would become a widow and his children fatherless. No such luck or mercy, and he is executed. February 21st of 1595, Robert Southwell was an English Catholic priest under the Jesuit order. He was convicted of high treason for his connections to the Holy See. Sadly, during his imprisonment, he was tortured. After 3 years, he is hanged. He is quoted saying this,
"I am decayed in memory with long and close imprisonment, and I have been tortured 10 times. I had rather have endured 10 executions. I speak not this for myself, but for others, that they may not be handled so inhumanely to drive men to desperation, if it were possible."
On June 23rd of 1649, a mass execution takes place where 23 men and one woman, well, they're hanged simultaneously. It took 8 carts to transfer the doomed prisoners to their deaths. January 30th of 1661, John Bradshaw is executed. Now, what differentiated Bradshaw with 99% of the others that were executed throughout the centuries was the simple fact that Mr. John Bradshaw was already deceased. You see, Bradshaw was the president of the High Court of Justice. He was the judge for the trial of King Charles I, and he signs the warrant that would allow the king to be executed. King Charles I is found guilty of being a tyrant, a traitor, a murderer, and a public enemy. Under the English law, a condemned man is no longer considered alive. And since dead people do not speak, you know, some people may think this, but I know that's not true, the king was considered dead and did not have the right to talk anymore. Now, Judge Bradshaw, he was a very firm believer when it came to this specific law, and he stood firmly behind it. King Charles I is executed in 1649. Judge Bradshaw dies over 10 years later in October of 1659, and he is buried with the greatest of honors at Westminster Abbey. While on his deathbed, Bradshaw mentioned that if he could execute the king over again, he would not hesitate in the slightest. The man died with no regrets, not a single one. The following year after Bradshaw's death, in 1660, Charles II is on the throne. And it is on the 30th day of January in 1661 that Charles II demands that Bradshaw be exhumed, along with 2 other men who had connections to him, and that even though they were already deceased, the 3 men would be executed. So John Bradshaw, Oliver Cromwell, and Henry Ireton are exhumed, unbeknownst to them or anyone else, from their temporary graves. A grisly display, the 3 men are chained to the gallows where anyone and everyone could just see them dangling there. The men, each one a judge, were then beheaded, and their bodies tossed clumsily together into a pit. And their heads, they are put on display at Westminster Hall. A week later, witnesses claimed the heads were still there, so God only knows how long those heads were put on display. As if to prove even more of a point, the king demands that Bradshaw's wife, who had nothing to do with anything, and who is also buried at Westminster Abbey, be exhumed and thrown into a common pit at St. Margaret's Westminster. This whole thing is like something that you would see in a movie, not real life. Three individuals, every single one of them a judge and already dead. They had no clue this was happening. The only thing this was proving was how sadistic and, dare I say, unstable King Charles II was. January 21st of 1670, a French highwayman named Claude Duval is executed after being found guilty of six robberies. His body is cut down from the gallows and displayed at the Tangier Tavern. Many would come to view the highwayman's body. December 19th of 1684, a mass execution takes place. Jan Vos was a highway robber and a notorious thief. The seven men executed with her, well, they were her accomplices. William Chaloner had spent many different prison terms throughout the years at Newgate Prison. This last one, however, he would be found guilty for a hanging offense, high treason. This repeat offender would be involved in many scams and forgeries. His judge for the trial had a reputation for sending people to their graves, and he was often referred to as the hanging judge. In one and final attempt to save his life, he writes a letter, and it reads this.
Oh, dear sir, do this merciful deed. Oh, my offending you has brought this upon me. Oh, for God's sake, if not mine, keep me from being murdered, oh, dear sir. Nobody can save me but you. Oh, God. Oh, God, I shall be murdered unless you save me. I hope God will move your heart with mercy, pity, to do this thing for me. I am your near-murdered humble servant.
Well, no such luck. And he is executed March 22nd of 1699. On November 16th of 1724, Jack Shepherd, better known as Honest Jack, is executed by being hanged at the Tyburn Gallows. Jack had been apprehended many times for being a thief, but guess what? He was a master when it came to escaping. He is only out of prison for a couple of weeks when he commits what would be his final crime, the crime that would seal his ultimate fate. He fakes being a beggar, breaks into a pawnbroker's shop, where he takes several things of extremely great value, including a sword, several different rings, watches, and a ton of other things. He is captured, found guilty, and a little over 2 weeks later, he is hanged. Before his execution, the King of Escapes plans one final escape attempt while at the gallows, but somebody finds his knife before he can do anything, thankfully. March 28th of 1759, Catherine Noland is sent to Tyburn to be hanged. When they arrive, it's noticed that some of the beams have been pulled down. For Catherine, there will be no stay of execution.
When she came to Tyburn, all the crossbeams were pulled down. So, she was tied up on top of one of the upright posts, and she was hung with her back to it.
By 1759, the gallows had fallen victim to vandalism several times, and they began using what they call the moving gallows. The first known execution that took place with the moving gallows occurs on October the 7th of 1759, when they execute four people at the same time, and then they're just simply carried away in the cart. May 4th of 1763, Hannah de Gough takes her final breath. Born in Ireland, she was a burglar and had been sent to the Whitechapel jail. While there, she stabs one of her fellow inmates. She was a rather burly and stout woman who intimidated the hell out of people. Well, after the stabbing, she is sent to Newgate, where she stabs yet another person. The reason? He had turned state evidence against his accomplices. Mind you, she was not one of those accomplices. She had nothing to do with this whatsoever. She just couldn't help but stick her nose in someone else's business. Hannah, she eventually robs a widow who had befriended her, and she takes everything from this woman, including her late husband's items, something that she held very near and dear to her heart. She is brought to trial at the Old Bailey and is sentenced to death. The day before her execution, she seemed like she had not a care in the world. The following day, she is en route to the Tyburn Gallows. She's quiet, she's reserved, she's keeping to herself. She ignores the priest as he's talking to her, probably trying to give her last rites and what have you. As they are under the gallows, while still in the cart, mind you, Hannah manages to get her arms, which were bound, free, and she attacks the executioner. Moments earlier, she was as cool as a cucumber. There's a struggle, so severe that it almost knocked the executioner completely out. She taunts the man who is about to take her life, and she starts taking off clothing and throwing it to the crowd as if she's an entertainer on the stage, throwing things to her anxious fans below. The man, he is eventually able to apprehend the mad woman and puts the noose around her neck. But before he can do anything, she wildly throws herself off from the cart, killing herself instantly. Wow, that must have been quite the show. That would be something interesting to watch, like it's a movie or something, you know? Go through this woman, her life, her crimes, and then her ultimate, what would be execution, but then, hey, I'm going to beat the executioner. And then we have November 3rd of 1783, John Austin, who would be the last person to be executed here at Tyburn Gallows. He was a highwayman and a murderer. And as he stood there with the noose around his neck, he was allowed to say any last words.
Good people, I request your prayers for the salvation of my departing soul. Let my example teach you to shun the bad ways I have followed. Keep good company and mind the word of God. Lord, have mercy on me. Jesus, look down with pity on me. Christ, please have mercy on my poor soul.
As the cart was taken from beneath his feet, the rope slipped up the back of the doomed man's neck. Due to the slack, he is not given a rapid death. He choked for 10 full minutes before finally dying. After this, the gallows, they are dismantled after being used for almost 600 years. And as we say goodbye, toodaloo, to the Tyburn Gallows, we now enter the public executions that were conducted in front of the prison. And again, this is just a mere handful, as several died. I believe it was 1,169 people were executed here at the actual prison. Public executions began at Newgate in 1783, but we're jumping ahead a few years. It is March 18th of 1789. Husband and wife team Catherine and Hugh Murphy are executed together. Their crime? Notorious counterfeiters. It was not only Catherine and Hugh who would be executed that fateful day. Seven others would die as well. Catherine would be the only woman, therefore she would be burned at the stake. You see, at that time, women, by law, were to be executed by being burned at the stake. Before Catherine is executed, they first hang her husband, Hugh, and the seven other men. The crimes in which they hang for, I am unsure of. Maybe they were fellow counterfeiters or something else. As their bodies are just there hanging, Catherine is forced to walk past them, knowing that her husband is one of those bodies. The Sheriff of London told the executioner to strangle her first, then, after death, burn her body at the stake. She is the last person to be executed in this type of fashion. And burning at the stake as a form of execution is abolished the next year by the Treason Act of 1790. January 28th of 1802, Joseph Wall, who was a British army officer, is executed for quite a brutal crime. He was one of those people that had an extreme power trip. And let's just say that the army officer was a sadistic son of a bitch. He took extreme pleasure when it came to inflicting pain on others. He got off on it. He is ultimately executed for the fatal whipping of some of his soldiers. Thousands came to witness him draw his final breath. And let's just say not many people would shed a tear. One day, he was drunk, and he began throwing orders around, and without a court-martial, demands several men get flogged. Corporal Thomas Upton received 350 lashes, and he died July 13th due to his injuries. Sergeant Benjamin Armstrong received 800 lashes, and he dies July 15th due to his injuries. Private George Patterson received 800 lashes, and he died July 19th due to his injuries. One drunk asshole, sadistically whipping these men several hundred times, mind you. Three men murdered. Very heartbreaking. If Joseph Wall did not deserve the death penalty, who the hell does? May 11th of 1812, John Bellingham murders British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, the only British Prime Minister ever to be assassinated. In his statement, he without a doubt 100% blames the murder victim. "Recollect, gentlemen, what was my situation? Recollect that my family was ruined and myself destroyed nearly because it was Mr. Perceval's pleasure that justice should not be granted, sheltering himself behind the imagined security of his station, and trampling upon law and right in the belief that no retribution could reach him. I demand only my right and not a favor. I demand what is the birthright and privilege of every Englishman. Gentlemen, when a minister sets himself above the laws, as Mr. Perceval did, he does it as is his own personal risk. If this were not so, the mere will of the minister would become the law, and what would then become of your liberties? I trust that this serious lesson will operate as a warning to all future ministers, and that they will henceforth do the thing that is right, for if the upper ranks of society are permitted to act wrong with impunity, the inferior ramifications will soon become wholly corrupted. Gentlemen, my life is in your hands. I rely confidently in your justice." Well, you know, this letter means absolutely not a damn thing. It falls on deaf ears, his desperate plea for his life to be spared. He is executed 3 days later. "Murder, oh my God," were the British Prime Minister's last words. He left behind a wife and 12 children, the youngest being 3 years old, and the oldest being 20. Some were way too young ever to truly know their father because he was brutally murdered. Executions began to take place within the prison walls starting in 1868. Again, we fast forward several years later. It is now November 15th of 1892. Enter Thomas Neal Cream. Thomas was better known as the Lambeth Poisoner. He was the type of person who people respected and trusted, for he was a doctor. But he took advantage of his medical authority, and in addition to being a doctor, he was also a serial killer. The Lambeth Poisoner took extreme pleasure in poisoning his victims. Most of them are shady ladies, soiled doves, ladies of the nights, prostitutes. Whatever you want to call them, that's what they were. Some of these women, they were pregnant, looking to get an abortion. Thomas, he had 10 confirmed murders under his belt. The number is possibly much higher, though. His last words were,
"I am Jack, the..."
This led many people to believe that he was none other than the notorious and unidentified serial killer Jack the Ripper. Mind you, Jack the Ripper was wreaking havoc in 1888, This is just a few years later in 1892, so thinking that it could possibly be him was not that far of a stretch. Thomas's murders would take place in Ontario, Canada, Chicago, Illinois, and London, England. So he was quite the international murderer, if you will. It took the jury at his murder trial less than an average grocery trip, only 12 minutes, to hand the guilty verdict, and he is sentenced to death. Among his victims was his very own wife, Flora. June 10th of 1896. Amelia Dyer breathes her last breath. I remember learning about this monster probably like 20 years ago or something. She was a notorious serial killer. Her victims were the most defenseless of people. Little babies. Yes, she was a notorious baby farmer. Many children would die under this monster's care. She was unstable. She had spent a lot of time in several different asylums. She had tried to kill herself at least once, but it's believed there were other times as well. She had been killing and getting away with murder for some time when one of her victims would come back to haunt her. The remains of an infant named Doris Marmon are discovered in the River Thames, and on her tiny body is evidence that directly links Amelia to the murder. Throughout the years, she murdered several babies and children. Sadly, the number of victims is not known, but some believe it to be in the several hundred. Some of her own family members are also charged as being accomplices to these heinous crimes. Something that did not sit well with the serial killer. Snuffing the life of an innocent human being who cannot even defend themselves, she had no problem with. In fact, she got a kick out of it. But her family taking any blame for her brutal actions did not sit well at all with her. It truly bugged her. Okay, good to know. The serial killer baby farmer had boundaries. She wrote this letter. Sir, will you kindly grant me the favor of presenting this to the magistrates on Saturday the 18th? Instant I have made the statement out, for I may not have the opportunity that I must relieve my mind. I do know, and I feel, my days are numbered on this earth. But I do feel it is an awful thing trying innocent people into trouble. I do know I should have to answer before my Maker in heaven for the awful crimes that I've committed. But as God Almighty is my judge in heaven and on earth, neither my daughter, Mary Ann Palmer, nor her husband, Alfred Ernest Palmer, I do most solemnly declare neither of them had anything at all to do with it. They never knew I contemplated doing such a wicked thing until it was too late. I am speaking the truth, and nothing but the truth, as I hope to be forgiven. I, and I alone, must stand before my Maker in heaven to answer at all. Witness my hand. Amelia Dyer.
Okay, first of all, really? Meeting her Maker in heaven? There's a special place for people in hell that do this kind of thing. Amelia, girl, you're going down. Anyways, she wrote this April 16th of 1896, less than 2 months before her execution. It took the jury less than 5 minutes to gift her with a guilty verdict. Like her victims, she would receive death.
Okay, now that we've heard a handful of the executions, now I want to talk a little bit about some of the executioners themselves, and some meet spine-tingling endings. Executioner Thomas Derrick, he had been convicted of rape. The Earl of Essex pardons him, saving him from certain death on the condition that he would become the executioner. This was something that Thomas happily accepted. During his time as the Tyburn executioner, he would conduct over 3,000 executions, including, get this, the execution of the very man who pardoned him. Yeah, the Earl of Essex.
Apparently, he had gone against Elizabeth I, and he was found guilty of treason, and he was beheaded. On the 25th day of February 1601, the Earl of Essex was beheaded on Tower Green. He would be the very last person to be beheaded in the Tower of London. It was reported that it took 3 strokes by Executioner Derrick to complete this ever so brutal execution. From 1639 up until his death in 1649, Richard Brandon was the executioner. I believe he was the executioner of Charles I. So I'm surprised Charles II didn't have him executed too. Also among those that he had executed was the Earl of Holland, the Duke of Hamilton, and Lord Capel. From 1649 up until 1663, Edward Dunne was the executioner. He's believed to have been the one to conduct the triple execution, and I use that word loosely, of the already dead judges that I mentioned earlier, Judge Bradshaw, Judge Cromwell, and Judge Ireton. Jack Ketch was employed by Charles II, and he was notoriously known for his disturbing botched executions. For example, Lord Russell's execution, well, it was a total shit show. Quote, Ketch wielded the instrument of death either with such sadistically nuanced skill or with such lack of simple dexterity, nobody could tell which, that the victim suffered horrifically under blow after blow, each excruciating, but not in itself lethal. Even among the bloodthirsty throngs that habitually attended English beheadings, the gory and agonizing display had created such outrage that Ketch felt moved to write and publish a pamphlet titled Apology, in which he excused his performance with the claim that Lord Russell had failed to, quote, dispose himself as was most suitable, unquote, and that he was therefore distracted while striking him on his neck, unquote. In 1686, the executioner is arrested after impersonating himself as the sheriff. Now, shockingly enough, this is not a lose-your-life-at-the-gallows offense. As I've read about some people being executed for stealing a loaf of bread back then, so impersonating the sheriff, not getting death for that, well, that kind of was shocking to me. Now, obviously, since he is in jail, he is relieved of his executioner duties, and enter Pascal Rose. He was an executioner assistant to Jack Ketch, and additionally, he was a butcher for the town. He stepped up as executioner when Jack is arrested, and this did not last long, though. Just a matter of months, really, when the executioner would become the executed. It turns out that Rose and an accomplice were arrested for breaking into a home and stealing, of all things, clothing. He is hanged May 28th of 1686 at Tyburn, where he had seen so many others meet their fate as executioner and assistant executioner. Jack is then reinstated. The king of botched executions, Jack, he is reinstated. But that very same year, he himself will die. Not executed, but he just dies. John Price is another executioner who would later be executed, where, in my opinion, Pascal Rose's crime was probably not death penalty worthy, stealing some clothing. I know he broke into a residence, and that's bad. Don't get me wrong, that's very bad. And unless he, like, beat the person living there and attacked them and killed them or something. But if that wasn't the case and he just stole some clothing, yeah, that's bad. Don't do that. Do some time for it. To die for it is kind of weird. But the same cannot be said for executioner John Price. murder. I believe his role as executioner was a rather short one, like Pasca. After a small handful of executions that he conducts, John is arrested for debt. He manages to escape prison, where he is free to murder a man in 1718. He then beats a woman so badly that she does die from her injuries less than a week after the attack. Price is captured, and he's found guilty of murder. He spends 5 weeks at Newgate Prison, and he is executed on the 31st day of May in 1718. Apparently, the days before his execution, while being imprisoned, obviously, he rapes a girl who had been instructed to bring food to his cell. He is a monster, and not many, if any, shed a tear over his death. During his execution days, executioner John Ellis conducted 203 executions within a 23-year span. He resigned shortly after the execution of Edith Thompson, whose execution shook him to the core. The very same year of Edith Thompson's execution, that being in 1924, he attempts to take his own life by putting a gun to his jaw and pulls the trigger. He survives this. Now, back then, suicide was considered a crime. The badly injured man is apprehended and spends over a year at Rochdale Magistrates Court. In 1932, he attempts suicide for the final time. This time, he uses a razor cutting his throat, and it is this final time that he is successful. I'm unsure if the execution of Edith Thompson had anything to do with his actions, but he was never the same after this specific execution. Just really quick, when it comes to Edith Jesse Thompson, she, along with her lover, Frederick Edward Bywaters, are executed. When it is found out that they murder her husband, Percy. Now, the last few days of her life, she let it be known that she was terrified to be executed. Never mind that she herself took a life. Her life was so much more important in her eyes. And she refused to eat. She would scream. She would just be completely out of her mind, out of control. The day of her execution, she collapses. She is that terrified that she collapses. And they carry her to the gallows, where she is eventually hanged. And this death really, really did affect John Ellis. Besides executions, there are several other types of deaths that took place here throughout the years. I mentioned earlier in the episode that the prison was actually temporarily shut down. At the time, the prison was in major disrepair, like seriously bad. It was decaying in some areas. Many prisoners would die due to disease, overcrowding issues, and unsanitary living conditions. At least 22 prisoners, possibly more, would die due to jail fever, also known as typhus fever. Common symptoms included headaches, rashes, severe fever. Anybody can have those. And if they think headache, they're not going to think, oh God, this is a fever that will kill me, you know? So I'm sure a lot of these illnesses were overlooked until it was just too late. In a one-year span, starting in 1315 and ending in 1316, a reported 62 deaths take place at Newgate. The coroner, they looked into this because it's like, why are so many people dying here in such a short amount of time? And I don't think they ever found out the cause. April 11th of 1665, Marcy Clay, better known as Jenny Fox. Well, she was doing time. She was nothing but a thief and a highway robber. And she takes her own life the day before her own scheduled execution. Yep, instead of meeting her fate at the Tyburn Gallows, she thought she would beat the executioner and take her own life. Well, you know, death did not come quickly for Marcy. You see, she poisoned herself with mercury. It would take her 12 long, excruciatingly painful hours for her to perish. Like an execution, a public one anyways, people were allowed to gather around and watch her die in bed. Hanging would have been a hell of a lot quicker, but she did die by her own hand, as she had planned. She sure showed them. She's buried 3 days later, right near the gallows. With suicides, a stake has to be driven through the bowels, so that's what they did with her before her burial. On November 1st of 1793, Lord George Gordon, in which Gordon Riots is named after, dies while serving his 5-year sentence at Newgate when he catches typhoid fever. The 1807 Newgate disaster, also known as the Old Bailey accident of 1807, occurs February 23rd of 1807. Picture it if you will. The gallows, it's ready for the triple execution that's going to take place later on that day. John Holloway and Owen Haggerty, they were found guilty of murdering a gentleman named John Cole Still. And the third to be executed is Elizabeth Godfrey, who is found guilty of stabbing somebody to death. So, 3 murderers, 3 executions, here we go. The crowds, they're ever so intense. It seems that everybody is wanting to watch these people die. One being a woman, and swinging themselves into eternity. Like, seriously, everyone. It was said that 40,000 people came that fateful day. John Holloway's last words were this: "Gentlemen, I am quite innocent of this affair. I never was with Hanfeld, nor do I know the spot. I will kneel and swear it." As the condemned are dropped to their deaths, many people watching are being pushed around, some wanting a better look, pushing, shoving. Remember, there are 40,000 people here. It must have felt like sardines overstuffed into the tiniest of canisters. One of the wooden carts, overloaded with people, breaks under the pressure. And as it collapses, several people are trampled, some being crushed to death. What should have been a day where 3 people died, and these 3 people were absolutely guilty of the worst crime ever, or one of the worst crimes ever, murder, it became the utmost heartbreak as 34 additional people are killed, and several others terribly injured. And last, I would like to talk quickly about the Black Dog legend that is connected to Newgate Prison. This legend dates back to 1596. That is at least the earliest account when it comes to this phantom dog. Luke Hutton was an author whose work included The Black Dog of Newgate, dated back in 1596, and another book called The Discovery of a London Monster called The Black Dog of Newgate in 1612. Why would Luke have so much knowledge about a dog in a notorious prison? Well, turns out he was serving time and handed a death sentence for robbery. He is eventually executed in York. Legend has it that during King Henry III's reign of England, a famine was occurring. I mean, that severely sucks, right? They're basically starving to death. Talk about absolutely a horrible way to go. Anyway, word is that it was so bad at Newgate that some of the inmates were forced to resort to something that would make most of the population cringe: cannibalism. Just your average meal for Jeffrey Dahmer, Alfred Packer, and Albert Fish. It all apparently starts one day when a young man is sent to Newgate, and the inmates eat him shortly after his arrival. Soon after this atrocity takes place, the men who committed the cannibalism begin to see this large, scary-looking black dog. Word is that the men, with the inmates' remains still in their bellies, believe the dog was the spirit of the man that they had just eaten. And it is said that this black dog at Newgate eventually would kill every single inmate that was responsible for this man's death. I mean, it is quite a woven tale, quite the legend, if you will. You know, I just love locations like this that just have hundreds of years of history behind them. And it is a shame that this location no longer exists. Specially handpicked specialty shoutouts from the jar this week go to Temecula, California. Cantonment, Florida, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Kent, Ohio, Terrebonne, Canada, and Calhoun, Georgia. Thanks, everybody, as always. It is greatly appreciated. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Really, there's no need to cry. Just head on over to any of those terrific podcast platforms right this very second, such as Pocket Cast, Downcast, Player FM, Apple Podcast, Spotify. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background.
See you next week.